We are going to Genesis chapter 33 this morning. Genesis chapter 33. All right, we'll read through the chapter this morning. Genesis 33, verse 1, the Bible says, Jacob lifted up his eyes and looked. Behold, Esau was coming and 400 men with him. So he divided the children among Leah and Rachel, and two female servants, and he put the servants with their children in front, then Leah with her children, and Rachel and Joseph last of all. He himself went on before them, bowing himself to the ground seven times until he came near to his brother. But Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept. When Esau lifted up his eyes and saw the women and children, he said, Who are these with you? Jacob said, The children whom God has graciously given your servant. Then the servants drew near, they and their children, and they bowed down. Leah likewise and her children drew near and bowed down. At last, Joseph and Rachel drew near, and they bowed down. Esau said, What do you mean by all this company, or all of this camp, is the word, that I met? Jacob answered, To find favor in the sight of my Lord. But Esau said, I have enough, my brother. Keep what you have for yourself. Jacob said, No, please. If I have found favor in your sight, then accept my present from my hand. For I have seen your face, which is like seeing the face of God, and you have accepted me. Please accept my blessing that is brought to you, because God has dealt graciously with me, and because I have enough. Thus he urged him, and he took it. Then Esau said, Let us journey on our way, and I will go ahead of you. But Jacob said to him, My Lord knows that the children are frail, and that the nursing flocks and herds are a care to me. If they're driven hard for one day, all the flocks will die. Let my Lord pass on ahead of his servant, and I will lead on slowly, at the pace of the livestock that are ahead of me, and at the pace of the children, until I come to my Lord at Seir. So Esau said, Well, let me leave with you some of the people who are with me. But he said, What need is there? Let me find favor in the sight of my Lord. So Esau returned that day on his way to Seir. But Jacob journeyed to Succoth, and built himself a house and made booths for his livestock. Therefore the name of that place is called Succoth. Jacob came safely to the city of Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan, on his way from Paddan Aram, and he camped before the city. And from the sons of Hamor, Shechem's father, he bought for 100 pieces of money the piece of land on which he had pitched his tent. There he erected an altar, and he called it El Elohe Israel. I don't know how it is in your house, but as I was growing up, there was one event that none of the men in the family really very much enjoyed. That was that day when you got to rearrange the living room. Whatever reason, every 5 or 6 months, it seemed, my mother got tired of the arrangement, and she thought it would spruce things up a little bit to change things around. It wasn't so bad until you got to the couch that had the hide-a-bed buried in it. And then when she wanted the piano moved, that was really a pain. And it wasn't so bad when it was all said and done. I mean, she has good taste. She had good positioning, and it looked good. It looked fresh. We always appreciated the product, but we didn't appreciate very much the process, because just as soon as you got that last piece of furniture in place, she'd say, Well, no, that's okay. Now let's try it over here. Oh, man. And then it would last that way for maybe 3, 4, maybe 5 months. And then, you know what, it's time to change the living room around again. And, oh, you wished that there would be some decisiveness. What was really bad is when it ended up the same way it started, because nothing else looked. When we come to this portion of Scripture, we've just gotten off this incredibly exciting passage where Jacob wrestles with the angel of the Lord. And all of us love Genesis chapter 32. There's spiritual victory. His name is changed. It's a decisive battle. And we see that Jacob is changed. And we're liking Jacob at this point. We haven't liked him very. There wasn't much to like about Jacob, other than he looks an awful lot like us in our conniving and construing things and manipulating things for our own advantage. But other than that, there's not a lot to like about Jacob up to this point. And so when he comes to this chapter 32, and he wrestles with the angel of the Lord, and just before that, he's on his knees, and he's begging God for his intervention and reminding God of his promise of blessing. And we say, you know what? This guy is getting it. There's a conversion. There's something that changed as he's been brought face to face with God, and he knows it. So chapter 33, you think the decisive battle has been fought, and now everything that follows out from his life is going to have this decisive flavor of victory. That's not necessarily the case. As we look at this passage this morning, we're reminded that faith can never afford us decisive resolutions when faith is compromised. And that's exactly what's going to happen for Jacob. He has genuine faith, but it's going to be a faith that is compromised, even as he pursues one resolution with man and one resolution with God. A resolution with Esau, a resolution with God, as he bows in worship at the end of this passage. I think this passage shows us two arenas then in which our faith is frequently compromised. We already mentioned it. There's only two arenas that it can be compromised in. In our dealings with man and in our dealings with God. This is where faith plays out. And as we look at the life of Jacob, his faith will be compromised first in this story as he encounters a man. Jacob's faith is compromised by seeking amends without a relationship. As we go through this story, we're familiar with all of the tension that's built up to this point. We know why Jacob is in trouble with Esau. We know that Jacob has played the hand well, in that he has gotten the upper hand on his older brother. He's stolen the birthright. He's stolen the blessing. There's reason for Esau not to trust him. There's reason for Esau not even to like him. As the older brother, the younger brother got the better of the situation. But as Jacob is coming back into the land, he's been confronted by none other than the angel of the Lord, probably the pre-incarnate Christ. And now all of a sudden he's changed. He sends out some feelers at the beginning of chapter 32 as he's coming back into the land. And we're reminded that with this heavenly commission, Jacob, come back to the promised land, God said. With this heavenly commission still ringing in his ears, Jacob begins to pursue. In fact, he initiates reconciliation. There's no way that he can come back into the land without dealing with that which drove him out of the land. And that was that tension with his brother Esau. So Jacob's return is at God's command. And as with most relationships, getting right with Esau is just a part of a larger pathway of obedience. When God calls us to join him in his purpose for our life, we're brought into context with people. That's just the way it works. And as God has a direction, he's moving, he's calling, he's bid Jacob to go, Jacob has to deal with this relationship on the way. It's just one part of a bigger program of obedience to God. Getting right with others, then, is always a part of being right with God. Isn't it amazing that we're never right with God in a vacuum? Whenever God calls us to get right with him, it always means getting right with people. That's the way it is with the Ten Commandments. The first four have exclusively you and your relationship to God. It's about you and him. Make sure that's right. And then from 5 through 10, the last six commandments are all about, now, because you're right with God, make sure that you live your life right with man, right with others. And so as Jacob has this decisive battle in his life, this conversion experience, as he understands himself for who he is, and he understands his God for who God is, it's right, it's appropriate that God would call him to get things right with his brother. Matthew chapter 5, Jesus says, if your brother has a problem with you, go take care of it. Matthew chapter 18, Jesus says, if you have a problem with your brother, go take care of it. In fact, one entire book is given in the New Testament
entirely in getting brothers right with each other. Philemon receives a letter from Paul along with a runaway slave, Onesimus. And Paul says, now you two, make it right, because Jesus Christ has removed that tension from you. Getting right with people is a big part of God's program. And so with this heavenly commission ringing in his ears, Jacob reaches out and initiates reconciliation. With heavenly boldness, Jacob requests God to intervene. Back in chapter 32, go back to verse 11. Jacob says, he's praying to God. He says, God, please deliver me from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him. They may come and attack me and the mothers with their children. At this point, predictably, Jacob is afraid. And he has reason to be afraid. He's fearing retaliation. What is Esau going to do? He may come and attack me. And even if he doesn't attack me, what if he doesn't forgive me? What if he still holds a grudge? Maybe he doesn't do something that overpowers me, that overwhelms me. But what if he just doesn't let go? At some point, he's going to look to take advantage of me. There's reason for fear. This fear is justified because it's his own doing. It was his fault that Esau's mad at him. He stole the birthright. He stole the blessing. He dressed up like Esau. He tricked his father into thinking that he was Esau. And he stole what rightfully belonged to Esau. And so Esau was mad at him. And rightfully so. Jacob's fears are simply a result of sowing and reaping. He had sowed manipulation. He had sowed selfishness. And now he's reaping the rewards that go along with that. But with heavenly boldness, he knows that there's reason to be afraid, but he reaches out and asks God to intervene in this relationship. You ever been afraid to try and make something right with somebody? You know you're in the wrong, and you don't know how they're going to respond. It was really stupid what you did, and they have every right to be mad at you. But you have to humble yourself. You ask God to intervene, and then you go. And you don't know how it's going to work. That's exactly where Jacob's at this point. We can see that Jacob is truly repentant when it comes to this place, because he not only acts in light of the heavenly commission, he doesn't only reach out with heavenly boldness and ask God to intervene, but he's aware of the heavenly blessing that's on his life. And with this blessing on his life, Jacob offers to make restitution. He had taken something from Esau, and he offers to give it back to some degree. Look down at verse 11 in chapter 33. As he's interacting with his brother, Jacob makes this powerful statement. He says, please, my brother Esau, accept my blessing that is brought to you, because God has graciously dealt with me. I have enough. He says, Esau, let me use the word. I really don't want to, but it's the elephant in the room. I have a blessing. Oh, really? Where'd you get this blessing? Esau, take the blessing that I have to offer you. God's given me so much, and I'm just giving it to you. Not everything, but enough that would show that he was truly sorry for what he did. And so the reminder, the word that he used would ring true in Esau's ear. But initially, Esau refuses. Verse 9, he says, Esau said, I have enough, my brother. Keep what you have for yourself. Now, it's interesting at this point, in this give and take between Jacob and Esau, Jacob is three times going to refer to the fact that it's God. It's God who's blessed me. It's God who's given me these children. It's God who's brought me to this land. In fact, seeing you is like seeing the face of God. And this language that Jacob now employs, having confronted God face to face and lived astoundingly, and recognizing that God has blessed him in his life, Jacob is now conversing with Esau with God as a reality in his conversation. It's just tripping off his tongue because he knows God to be a reality in his life. And as Esau looks at this blessing, he says, my brother, I have enough. I don't need your blessing. And it doesn't say it in so much. I mean, as we look at this part of the story, Esau's a good guy. Esau's a brother who's willing to let bygones be bygones. Okay, the water's over the dam. He's not chasing down that stream anymore. It's done. We see him, in fact, he's the bigger brother. He's running. And remember, he's this big outdoors guy. It's like Jeff Barr coming up here and running up and giving me a big hug and planting a kiss, right? Like we were talking about with the missionaries last week, okay? I mean, here's this big, burly Cabela's guy coming out and giving his little brother a hug, and he breaks down and he's a ball baby. He's crying on his brother's neck, okay? As you look at this story, Esau's a pretty lovable guy. But with this interaction between Jacob and Esau, Jacob is profoundly aware that everything I have has been touched by God in my life. Esau, when I went away, I was trying to get everything that I could. I'm coming back to you a different man because God has touched me. He's wrestled with me. He's stripped me of me, and then he's given me so much. In fact, the word that Jacob uses here in verse 11, I have enough. The word is literally, I have everything. I have all. I've got God. I don't have need of anything because God, I can give you, and God will give me more than what I can take care of, more than I can hold, more than I can get my arms around. There's no more reason for me to try to take, for me to try to get, because I have God. And I not only have enough, but I have everything. Esau, on the other hand, says, you know what, Jacob? You took from me the blessing, this blessing from God, but you know, I really don't need it. I'm doing all right. I've got wives. I've got kids. We'll look up at that in chapter 36. I've got 400 men coming with me, for crying out loud. I've got servants. I've got, what do you have that I don't have? Jacob's over here. I've got so much, and it all came from God. Esau's saying, I've got so much, and I don't need God. And though it's not front and center in the story, it's underlying. And the book of Hebrews picks up on it and says, you know what? Esau was an unholy man. Because for just one bowl of pottage, he sold that which was eternal. And then he seemed to do okay on planet Earth. But he never longed for the blessing of God himself in his life. So as Jacob returns with the heavenly blessing, he offers restitution, and he mentions God over and over again in this interaction. These are the good things that Jacob does. He's touched, he's different, he's changed. As Tim preached last week, he's been converted. God has done the work of conversion and changing him from the inside out. But on the flip side of it, his faith is compromised with human wisdom as Jacob anticipates the worst. You see up in verse 1, Jacob lifted up his eyes and he looked, and the word is kind of a surprise word. Aha! Behold, Esau was coming, and with him 400 men. He's still on his way to meet Esau. He's looking out down the road. In fact, as the story picks up right off of chapter 32, verse 31, the sun rose up and he's limping from this agonizing night-long wrestle. He's limping. And as he's limping, kind of looking over his shoulder, wow, I can't believe I just got out of that. He looks up. There's Esau. Wow. I'm in no condition to wrestle with him after just wrestling with the angel of God. What are we going to do? How are we going to handle this? So he makes this plan. Middle of verse 1, he divided the children among Leah, Rachel, two female servants. He put the servants with their children in front. He puts Leah with her children behind. Then he takes Joseph and Rachel and he puts them last of all. Then he goes in front of them. He's not as bad as all that. Like, you guys go and protect me. He comes out in front, okay, in front of all his wives and kids. And he's going to take the first wave of the attack. But just in case, Jacob plans on the worst. He anticipates the worst and the one that he's going to be You ever do that? You go and you're anticipating, God told me to do this. I've got to make this right. I'm going to humble myself. I'm going to make restitution. I'll do whatever I have to do to make this right. But it's probably not going to work. This is probably like spitting in the wind. And basically, he's planning on failure at this point. God, would you take care of us? But just in case you don't, let me put my favorite wife and child in the back. My other legitimate wife and children in front of them. And then my servants and their children in front. God, in case you don't come through, I'll try to take the least hit possible. The blatancy of this division undoubtedly serves to exacerbate the jealousies that are already there in these four women and their children. You come up to chapter 37, verses 3 and 4, and you see that all the other kids have nothing good to say to Joseph. Well, you think? So you know that dad has a favorite. He buys him a coat of many colors. When did you know that? I knew that from the day when he lined us up by who he was ready to get rid of first. And guess what? I was in the front. Can you imagine being Naphtali, Asher, one of those guys out in the very, Zebulun. Hey, what's Joseph doing back there, Mom? Shh, he's Daddy's favorite. Well, why are we up here? Because we're not Daddy's favorite. In Jacob's family, you knew where you stood. Okay, and it's no surprise. Jacob grew up in a home where Jacob was Mommy's favorite. Esau was Daddy's favorite. He's just playing out. But with human wisdom, he anticipates the worst. With human deference, Jacob maintains a polite distance. We come up to verse 2, verse 3. Jacob goes in front, and as he's going, he's bowing himself down to the ground, all the way down to the ground. Takes a few steps and then bows down on the ground and gets back up, then bows down seven times. Seven times was the number that they would do it in a royal court. As you would approach the king, you would bow down, prostrate yourself in front of the king, take a couple more steps, and do it seven times. As Jacob approaches his brother, there's an officialness to this meeting. And he's bowing himself. In fact, he brings each of his wives and their children, and they bow down. First the servants, then Leah, then Rachel and Joseph. But then you look at the picture of Esau, verse 4. But Esau ran to him, embraced him, fell on his neck and kissed him. And then they blubbered about it for a bit. Decorum, forget it. This is my brother. Oh, runs up, almost trips along the way. I can't imagine this big old guy pulling up his robes and running. It's my brother. Grabs on him by the neck, gives him a bear hug, a smooch or two, and then they're crying. Hey, all the decorum's out the window. But Jacob's very careful in the posture that he's presenting to his brother. He's giving him deference. There's humble titles. In verse 5, he says, Esau, I'm your servant. And then five times over the course of this conversation, he references Esau as my lord. My lord. You can kind of picture him just giving a gentle bow. My lord, if you would please allow me to find favor in your sight. My lord, my lord. In fact, it's almost a groveling that Jacob does at this point. In doing so, Jacob gives up part of what God had said would be his by right. Jacob, you're a prince with God and with man. Jacob, yours is the blessing that your brothers will serve you. You will be their lord. They will be your servants. But Jacob goes out of his way to say, no, I'm your servant, you're my lord. Whatever you say, I just need to bow to you. There's humble titles. There's humble motives. Over and over again, three different times, he says, I just want to find favor in your sight. I just want to find favor in your sight. Verse 8, verse 10, verse 15. Just let me find favor in your sight. And that idea of in your sight has the idea of just your judgment of me is most important. I want you to like me. I want that which was between us to be gone. And what's most important to me now is that you like me. There's definitely a fear of man that's going on in Jacob's life at this point. But when fear of man controls us, what doesn't? Fear of God. Okay? The fear of man bringeth a snare, the book of Proverbs says. And this is exactly what Jacob's wrestling with. Does he fear God? Yes. But who does he fear more than God at this point? Esau. Esau. He's tripping over himself to put himself under him. With human tact, then, at the end of this passage, Jacob deceives only himself. He employs flattery. Verse 10. Esau, to see your face. Why, that's to see the face of God. And this could be taken two ways, okay? And it's stated in such a way that it's supposed to be taken in two ways. He's tacitly acknowledging God's sovereignty in taking away Esau's evil disposition toward him. You know what, Esau? When I see you crying, when I see that bitterness gone from your eye, I know that it's not Esau. I know that it's God who took that away from you, who broke that down and wiped that away. I see God at work in your life, Esau. But he says it in such a way that he doesn't explain it. You see, Esau, I know that it was God working in you. He says it in such a way that it serves a secondary purpose. Esau, to see your face is like to see the face of a god, or the gods. Okay? And we don't know how Esau took it at this point, but there's intended some flattery as he goes on. He provides some excuses down in verse 13. Esau says, my brother, forget this Lord servant stuff. You're my brother. Why don't you come with me? We'll go on down to Seir together. He says, No, I can't just yet. There's the kids. Esau, I can't. There's the cattle. I can't push them too hard. Well, how about I leave some people with you? There's no need. Just let me find favor in your sight, my lord. Okay. He makes a promise. We'll just go on at an easy pace until we come down to you at Seir. I don't know if you ever watched Mary Poppins. She calls them pie crust promises. Easily made, easily broken. Okay? We'll just take our time. We'll join you down in Seir. How long is it going to take? You know, I really can't tell you. Well, how do I know when I'm supposed to look for you? We'll be there. You ever try to invite somebody or to make a connection, set up some appointment? When does it work for you? I'll have to get back. Well, how about Tuesday? Yeah, you know what? I don't know. I'm going to have to check my calendar. How about Thursday? You know what? I'll get back to you on that one. And it's like, yeah, thanks. You're not either. You're only kidding yourself. Jacob's doing the same thing. And finally, Esau takes off. You know, the one thing that Jacob avoids in all of this, the one policy that he refuses to try, is just telling him the truth. You know, Esau, I'd love to come visit you in Seir, but there's something that's really big in my heart right now. God called me back to a place where he introduced me to himself for the very first time. That place is called Bethel. I'm supposed to go back there. In fact, I'm bringing an offering to him. Esau, that's where I've got to go. And then I've got to stop and see Dad. I'd love to come down, Esau, and maybe sometime I will. But right now, here's what I've got to do. Why is it that telling the truth is so often the hardest policy? But it's also the simplest, it's the easiest, it's the best. And you would think, Jacob, you're a new man. How come faith doesn't live itself out in that arena of man's relationship with man? And you say, Jacob, you're so like me. I know Jesus Christ. I love Jesus Christ. I've been touched by Jesus Christ. And faith ought to be decisive in my life. And it is. Almost. Kind of. I want it to be. And we want Jacob to turn this page, turn this corner, and we see that he's wrestling. He's a new person, but his faith doesn't bring a decisive resolution, because what Jacob was seeking at this moment wasn't a relationship with his brother. He was just seeking amends. He was looking to get rid of that thing that stood between them because that was jeopardizing him. Who was Jacob thinking about in this restitution, in this resolution with Esau? He wasn't thinking about Esau, was he? Jacob was still thinking about Jacob. As we look at this, we see that Jacob's faith was compromised in the arena of man, seeking amends without relationship. In short, he wanted peace by putting a band-aid on the past without having to invest it all in the future. Don't we do the same when we apologize simply to remove the social embarrassment, but we don't want to pursue any relational intimacy? Don't we do the same when we use others and their acceptance or their friendship to ease our conscience or make us feel important without really caring about them, caring more for ourselves? I think it's easier for us to bow and to flatter and to promise at a distance than it is for us to run and to hug and to kiss and to weep. I don't like doing that. I don't like getting close where I have to say I'm sorry. I don't like getting close where I might be responsible for you. I don't like getting close where you might have to be responsible for me. Let's just make sure things are okay, and then you can go your way and live your life, and I can go my way and live my life. But that's not what he's called to. Because God got involved in Jacob's life. God calls him into relationship. Not just with God, but relationship with others. And Jacob is fighting that, and he's fighting it much like you and I do as well. That's why so many people, in coming to know Jesus Christ, say, "What do I need a church for? I can worship with God. We do great when I'm out fishing, when I'm out on the golf course, when I'm out on the ski hill. I don't need to be in a church." You need to be in a church, and you need to be linked up with a church, because whenever God calls you to be right with Him, He also calls you to get right with people. And that's what Jacob misses out in the beginning of this story. We see the second arena where his faith is compromised, and that's with God. Jacob's faith is compromised by worshiping while remaining focused on his own welfare. Verses 17 down through 20. Verse 16 says, "So Esau leaves, he goes his way down to Seir. But Jacob journeyed to Succoth, and he built himself a house and made booths for his livestock. Therefore the name of the place is called Succoth." So one verse gives us a little bit of information. It's like, okay, thanks. Don't know where any of those things are, and we move on. This is important. When God, let's go back to chapter 31, verse 3, and then verse 13. Verse 3 in chapter 31, "The Lord said to Jacob, 'Return to the land of your fathers and to your kindred, and I will be with you.'" Okay, well, what's that supposed to look like? Verse 13, "Jacob, remember, I am the God of Bethel, the house of God, that place where you anointed a pillar, that place that you made a vow to me, that you were going to return to that pillar, you were going to return to that place, and I would be your God. You would give me an offering. Now arise, go out from this land, and return to the land of your kindred." And implied in this call to Jacob, it's, Jacob, come back to the land and remember Bethel. Remember that place where you said that you would meet with me again. I'm calling you back to that place. And so Jacob comes to the land. He wrestles with the angel of God. He takes care of that thing that drove him from the land. And now we would think Jacob is bound for Bethel, right? You would think that would be the next verse, verse 17. And so Jacob packs up his things, and he journeys to Bethel. No, journeys to Succoth. Succoth. He built himself a house, and he made booths. And I have to say that so carefully, otherwise it sounds like he has inebriated livestock. He made booths for his livestock. What's going on here? It's interesting, up to this point, the only other time that we have a house mentioned in Scripture is when Lot builds for himself a house in the city of Sodom. He had taken up permanent residence. If we were to look at the land of Israel, we have the Jordan River, going from the Sea of Galilee down to the Dead Sea. Cuts right in half here. And on, from your side of the sea, on this side would be the land of Canaan. On this side would be the Mesopotamian, Syria, and Moab's down here. Edom, where Esau is down at the bottom. But the thing that divides is that Jordan River. And so as he comes to the Jordan, he crosses down over the Jabbok, which isn't yet to the Jordan River. He comes to Succoth, and Succoth is on the non-Canaan side of the Jordan River. And here we have this patriarch who's been changed by God, been touched by God. And he's going to spend some time in a safe place. And that's what Succoth is. It seems that at this point, the focus shifts from where he was going, Bethel, to where there was no way he was going, down to Seir, down to Edom, down to be with his brother. He lost sight of his bearings. I forget where I'm going because all of a sudden I know where I'm not going. And rather than being driven by the fear of God back to Bethel, he's driven by the fear of man to finding a safe place and holding up there for a bit. And we're not told how long he does it, but it says he stays there. We see he's not yet in the land of Canaan because verse 18 says when he gets to Shechem, he's finally in the land of Canaan. The focus seems to shift from his pilgrim worship to a settled comfort. He's building himself a house rather than pursuing the Beth-El, the house of God, the Bayit-El, the house of God. Jacob says, you know what? I can go to the house of God anytime. I'm going to build myself a fortress. I'm going to build myself a safe place. And then he builds booths for his livestock. And the idea is, not only do I have to take care of myself, I have to take care of my possessions. When Jacob had met with God, or God had met with Jacob on his way out of the land, running from his own iniquity, running from his brother, God catches up with him and says, Jacob, I want to be your God. And Jacob says, God, if you'll do this for me, if you'll put food in my stomach and clothes on my back, and if you bring me in peace to this place where I'm anointing this pillar that I'm calling Bethel, house of God, if you do that for me, you'll be my God. And not only will you be my God, I will give you 10% of everything you give me. Whatever you give me, I'm going to give it back to you because you're my God. That's what he says. At this point now in the story, he's back to the land. He's on the verge of entering into the land, but he's forgotten about God's house. And those possessions that he's been given by God, he's not looking to give them back to God. He's looking to hoard them again for himself. Wow! You feel like you're in a pinball machine with this guy. He's good, then he's bad. He's giving, then he's taking. He's guarding, he's protecting, he's launching out. What's wrong with this guy? He's giving me whiplash, spiritual whiplash, as I look at his life. This is the beauty of the story of Jacob. Because when we get through with the life of Jacob, there's no other name that's repeated more often than himself, where he says, I am the God of Jacob. I'm the God of Israel. I am the God of this one who looks so anemic and looks so much like you. He looks so much like me. God says, this is the kind of people that I love being God of. In verse 18, we see that Jacob makes his way to Shechem. And this is a long stay, but it's in the wrong place. We're not told how long he stays in Shechem, but in chapter 34, we see that little Dinah, who was probably 6 or 7 years old when she comes to this point, is mature enough to be sought after as a wife. So he stays in this safe place for a while. He comes to Shechem, and it's in the land. It's notably in the land of Canaan, the Bible says. In fact, it's the place where Jacob's well is. In John chapter 4, when Jesus is interacting with the woman of Samaria, Shechem is the place of Jacob's well. It's the place where Abraham entered the land and built his first altar there. So it's a good place to be, but it's not the place he was supposed to be. He was supposed to go back to Bethel, to that place where God had met him, to that place where he had promised to return. It wasn't the place he was supposed to go. This delay in obedience is going to cost both him and his family dearly. When Dinah is defiled, and the vengeance of his sons overtakes them, and he makes them a stench to the people of the land. We come down to verse 20. Verse 19, he buys the piece of land for some money. He's planning to stay there. He purchases. It's like the purchase of the cave of Machpelah. This is my place. This is where I fit. This is what's been promised to me. And I own it. I want it. He still loves what God's promised him. We come to verse 20. It says, and there he erected an altar. And he called the name of this altar El Elohe Israel. It's notable that back up in verse 18 it says, Jacob came safely. He came in peace. One of the requirements for Jacob to take God as his God would be that God would bring him in peace back to this land. So he comes in peace. What does Jacob do? He sets up an altar and he says, God, I made a promise to you that you would be my God. And as he names this altar, he acknowledges the fact that God is now his own. Throughout this story, he gives us clues that he didn't see God as his God. Back in chapter 31, verse 53, he makes a vow between him and Laban. I swear by the God of my father Isaac that I'll not come to you to hurt you. What's that? Why don't you just swear by your God? He's the God of my father Isaac. But now he's saying, you know what? This God, he is my God. He's my God. But he not only acknowledges that this God belongs to him, he acknowledges that he himself is no longer the same man as when he left. He doesn't say, this is the God of Jacob. He says, this is the God of the new man, Israel. I've been changed. This God has changed me. Is my obedience perfect? We can say, no. Okay. But is there a genuine inclination in his heart to serve God, to worship God, to seek God, to please? There is. And so it's a mixed bag. But as we come to this passage, we see that worship is a genuine priority, but it's not the priority in his life. And as he's working to worship God, he's still guarding himself. He's still protecting himself. He's making himself comfortable. He's seen to meet his own needs because he doesn't just yet know whether or not he can trust this God that he calls his own. And in the next several chapters, God still has to teach his servant more about cultivating his own comfort, more about seeking his own self-preservation. In fact, he's going to send him a famine to get him out of the land and show, you know what, Jacob, I can take care of you even by putting your son in bondage, so that I can raise him up to that place where he will be a shepherd to my people. This is an amazing story. It's amazing because chapter 32 provides for us that decisive victory. And Jacob is changed. He's converted. He's God's man. But it doesn't play out very decisively in his interactions with Esau, where he's looking out more for himself and doesn't necessarily want that relationship. It doesn't necessarily play out in the arena with God where he wants to worship, but he's still kind of protecting and taking care of himself. You know what? That's a hard place to be, isn't it? You want the furniture to be moved and you want it to stay in its place. But when you look at this, you go up to the book of Hebrews and it says, God is not ashamed to be called their God. Because though their faith was anemic, though it seems partial, their faith was genuine. And God was at work in their lives. But here's the thing, folks. Your faith will not provide a decisive resolution in your life if you allow it to be compromised by fear, if you allow it to be compromised by self-preservation, if you allow your faith to be compromised by seeking my own comfort rather than seeking and pursuing obedience to God. There's so much that can compromise our faith. And so, like Mike mentioned in the Sunday school this morning. We have to live on guard, building up our life of faith with that trowel in one hand and living on guard with that sword in the other for everything that would sneak into our lives and derail our faith. We live with a sword and a trowel, slowly, slowly learning to walk by faith, not by sight.